Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by California College of the Arts, offering extension courses focused on design, fine arts, and digital technology. Campuses in Rock Ridge, Oakland, and Potrero Hill in San Francisco. cca.edu/extension.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, the economy's on the mend, but unemployment for young adults is still really high. Our summer jobs programs simply make work or something more. Also, our graduation day series continues with a high school senior communicating through her poetry.
I write, I suppose, what feels most real at any moment. It can be any kind of experience that is so moving that it demands to be written down.
Also, a Cambodian community remembers the painful history of the Khmer Rouge killing fields. And on this Memorial Day weekend, a music ensemble made up of military moms.
Sometimes they'll be just enjoying it and laughing and having a great time, and the next song they will be crying. It just brings back so many memories for them. It really is amazing.
It's the California Report. Memorial Day weekend is upon us, and in addition to remembering and honoring those who died in war, it means road trips, backyard barbecues, baseball games, and more. It's also the unofficial start of summer, and for some teens and young adults comes the hope, or dread, of finding a summer job. In the San Francisco Bay Area, where the unemployment rate is 17% for people between the ages of 16 and 24, the jobs are looking for them.
Want to update your status? Get a summer job today. Thousands of jobs available for 16 to 24-year-olds at places like Old Navy, Bank of America, and more. Text JOBS at 50555 now.
That public service announcement is being heard on radio stations here. The city is setting a goal of finding 4,000 public sector and 2,000 private sector summer jobs and internships for young folks this summer.
So my name is Tomas Sheikh. I'm 18 years old.
Tomas Sheikh was one of those summer interns last year after graduating from high school. He was born in Karachi, Pakistan, and came here with his family when he was 4. Tomas remembers his first thoughts when his parents told him he had to find work for the summer.
I have no experience. How am I supposed to get a job, you know?
Sheikh was interviewed by Virginia Mead, office manager at the Bohan Company. She's hired as many as 7 interns at a time for this fairly small office that serves apartment building owners and homeowners associations.
What do you look for in an intern?
Somebody's listening. Being teachable is a unique quality, and he was totally in the moment. He's right there listening and realizing the opportunity that he has. It's not just a place that he's parked himself.
This week, about a year after last year's summer internship ended, Tomas Sheikh is parked here, wearing a crisp white shirt, sitting in his own cubicle.
I take bank statements. I go to our accounting software. You know, I reconcile the banks. You know, this is accounting 101. So, you know, I'm learning as I'm going.
The day his internship ended last year, the Bohan Company offered Tomas a job.
Immediately, I said, okay, you know, I'm going to take this opportunity. I'm going to see what it offers me. And I get to work in the Embarcadero, you know, suit up a little bit, have a little cubicle. So it's not bad, you know, for an 18-year-old, come on.
The best kinds of summer jobs can put young people in touch with adults who mentor them, people like Virginia Mead.
I told him, no matter if you want to be an accountant or not, whatever you learn here will be a basis for wherever you go next. So take it seriously.
This program, it's called Summer Jobs Plus, is part of the Obama administration's goal of reaching out to young people from low-income families and underserved communities. Here, it's a partnership between the City of San Francisco and United Way of the Bay Area. Matt Poland runs the private sector portion of it. Part of his job is making sure the young people are what he calls work-ready, trait, he says, is somewhat subjective and nuanced.
But some of the basics are having a resume that's presentable, being able to answer interview questions, being able to show interest and motivation to work, knowing how to dress, knowing how to interact in an interview, and filling out a job application too online, which can be tricky.
All these summer jobs pay either the minimum wage of $10.55 an hour or a stipend. How do you ensure that it's not a make-work job or a dead-end job or something that's not going to be of use to them once they leave?
We do make sure we've vetted the employer, talked to them a little bit about what kind of jobs they're offering. We are selective in trying to find opportunities that the young people can learn from.
This being San Francisco, there are some unusual opportunities, like ones with the organization putting on this year's America's Cup. Some of the more popular jobs, Poland says, are ones with companies young people know. Starbucks, Nike Town, Ghirardelli, and Airbnb.
The intent of Summer Jobs Plus is really to start building a system that better aligns workforce and education. And so reinforcing their education with learning on the job so they understand their education, and then also knowing that education is vital to getting a job and getting a self-sustaining wage and that sort of thing.
And summer internships can also be a gateway into something better. Just ask Tomas Shake. And what do you think you learned at the internship?
It basically inspired me to, you know, go viral, you know, that I have an opportunity to become something, you know. It opened doors for me.
Tomas is now a freshman at San Francisco State, majoring in computer engineering with a minor in accounting. As college freshmen like Tomas Shake would tell you, the last year of high school can be exciting, but for even the brightest students, it can also be lonely. Today, as part of our graduation day series, we meet high school senior Kenzie Givens, a straight-A student from Los Angeles who uses poetry to navigate questions of race and isolation.
Give it up for Kenzie Givens!
On a chilly night in South LA, over 100 young people have packed into this small theater for an open mic poetry reading. Kenzie Givens is a 17-year-old poet, and tonight's her first time reading here.
I would be lying to you if I said I was afraid of death. I crave life, and in doing so, crave death.
On stage, Kenzie looks tough. She's dressed in a leather jacket, miniskirt, and combat boots, and her hair is done up in dreads. Despite her confidence on stage, Kenzie doesn't always fit in. She writes poetry because she can't always connect with other students her age.
When I'm at school, I'm usually pretty shy. I have this little place where I sit off. It's actually behind this little shrubbery thing, and that's usually where I go when I eat my lunch. And if I am around people, my head tends to be in a book.
Kenzie doesn't go to school in her own African-American neighborhood. In the third grade, her parents chose to start sending her to charter schools in mostly white, wealthy neighborhoods. She felt like an outsider from an early age.
I tried to make friends with people, and I tried to, like, ingratiate myself into different groups and stuff, but again, I found out that, you know, in order to do that, I'd have to be someone who I was not, and that didn't really appeal to me, and so I just kind of decided to be stubborn and stick it out alone.
Kenzie occupies a very different world when she's away from school. The Crenshaw neighborhood in central L.A. is over 70% African-American. Signs on shop doors read Black-owned and Support the Hood. In a tiny hair salon, Kenzie gets her dreads done while her father, Darren, chats with the other fathers assembled there. He explains why it was important to him to raise his children here.
For them to be in an environment where, one, they would be safe, but they'd be around their own people, able to go outside and play, drive around, but participate in the neighborhood, be able to go down and go to their own stores and different things.
Back at home, Kenzie's mother, Caroline, admits it wasn't easy sending her to a school in a different neighborhood.
I would have liked her to have more African-American friends as well, which I think she doesn't have as many. Does she have any? I don't think she has any. No.
I'm certain there's, you know, someone at my school that I could have really great conversations with and have a really great time with, but I usually am so focused on my books and so focused on exploring, you know, topics on my own that I don't really get to talk about it with anyone. Like, I've never had a boyfriend, or maybe my boyfriend has been a book, I'm not sure.
So are you lonely?
A little, but it's not forever, so, because there's college.
In the meantime, as a way of sharing her work and to connect with others, Kenzie started a poetry club at her charter school in the Palisades near the beach. During a drizzly lunch period, four teenagers assemble in a classroom to read their poems.
I wrote this poem called English Summer Rain. It's based off of the lyrics of the
There are song. No notebooks here, no scribbled journals. The students write and read their poems from their cell phone screens, their fingers scrolling their words.
And it's for a friend of mine that passed away recently.
Who are we but our scars? Constantly.
I'm here trapped in this dark cave, unable to say anything.
This is a poem about war. The idea kind of got in my mind when I was looking up ominous things on YouTube.
I write, I suppose, what feels most real at any moment. It can be any kind of experience that is so moving that it demands to be written down. I think my biggest fear is probably a very common one, and that is of disappearing entirely. I'd like to know that I mattered.
On the night of her first reading, Kenzie's nervousness melts away.
I want to be consumed by some primal beast. I want to live authentic.
She looks grounded, confident about her future. This fall, she's heading to Reed College in Portland, where she's secured early admission and a scholarship. Meanwhile, here in this crowded theater full of poets and performance artists, she's no outsider. On stage, Kenzie Givens is at home.
I want to live while dying, die while living and be reborn so I can do it again tomorrow. I want something pure. I would be lying to you if I said I was afraid of life.
For the California Report, I'm Leah Bailey in Los Angeles.
That story was produced in collaboration with the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. Next up in our graduation day series, the difficulty of staying in school when the pull of gang life is so strong. This Memorial Day weekend, many families will visit grave sites to honor those killed in the military. But this next story is about families who have no grave sites to go to. Instead, to remember their loved ones, Cambodian Americans are teaching a younger generation about their people's history. Reporter Dwahli Saikautau has this story from Long Beach.
Check, check. What's up, man?
Rapper Joan Lee helped ring in the Khmer New Year, or Cambodian New Year, last month. The young audience at Eldorado Park knows a lot about Lee's music, but probably less about the Killing Fields, or the Communist Party of Cambodia, known as the Khmer Rouge. And since New Year also marks the 38th anniversary of the rise of this socialist regime, local leaders are holding informal teach-ins. Over at nearby MacArthur Park, a different audience watches a video of Cambodians testifying about the atrocities they witnessed between 1975 and 1979. That's when an estimated 2 million people were killed by the Khmer Rouge. 67-year-old Kano Nuon fled Cambodia 2 years later.
We try to teach the new generation to remember, to understand, but they are more American.
Nuon says he nearly starved to death in a Khmer Rouge labor camp.
That time, very hard for me. I'm sorry. I still remember everything about my hard time. With the communists, you know. That's it. I'm sorry about that, okay?
Another survivor is Bryant Ben. He's president of the Killing Fields Memorial Center, a group raising money to construct a memorial park in Long Beach. Ben says the memories are painful, but the older generation must tell their stories.
The picture that you see here is my oldest brother. His name is Saruan Ben.
The brothers were imprisoned in a makeshift Khmer Rouge labor camp at a temple in the Cambodian countryside. The last time the brothers saw each other, Ben was about to have rice soup for lunch. His brother managed to get close enough to slip him some anti-diarrhea pills.
He came, sneaked behind me. He gave me some medicine. He said, this is all that's what he has. Take care of yourself. He told me, take the last time I can hear from him.
Among those on the regime's hit list were intellectuals, college students like Ben and his brother. During an interrogation, Ben lied about his studies. His brother Sarun did not. The Khmer Rouge killed Sarun and would also execute Ben's father, four of his brothers and sisters. In an auditorium at Long Beach City College, a Buddhist monk offers a New Year blessing. At this event, more survivors of the Cambodian genocide are reaching out to both college and high school students.
I don't really know much about the genocide because my mom doesn't tell me about it. And my grandma don't want to tell me about it.
Jenna Coy is a senior at Long Beach Polytechnic High School.
They probably don't want us to know like how like their life used to be in Cambodia. And I just don't ask them.
But on this day, Coy is about to learn why some first-generation refugees have difficulty talking about their past. Victory Hang was a child when the Khmer Rouge took over Cambodia. He used to tell people that the communists killed his father, but for the first time, he admits before an audience of several hundred people that his father actually committed suicide.
No, my father was not a coward. My father was a hero and the preserver of our lives.
So much for being here. It's not by chance, but by choice that you all here tonight.
Sarah Pol Lim is executive director of United Cambodian Community. She organized this speak out, in part because she says studies by the RAND Corporation showed Cambodian refugees still struggle with major depression and an unusually high rate of PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder.
The ripple effect of that post-traumatic stress syndrome doesn't go to second generation. It will go to third, it will go to fourth, if we will never talk about it.
To encourage parents and children to talk about the Cambodian genocide, Pol Lim invited Judy Green of Temple Israel in Long Beach to share her experience as a second-generation Holocaust survivor. Green remembers asking her mom,
"What happened to my grandparents?" And my mother's face turned in such a way that I never asked my mother that question again.
33 years later, Green's mother slowly began to talk about the day when her father was taken away by Nazi soldiers and never seen again.
It is a long time before you can begin to even come close to some of the conversations where there's great pain.
These conversations, Green adds, begin the process of healing a community that has lost so much and so many. For the California Report, I'm Duahli Saikautau in Long Beach.
Many musicians use their music to work through grief after the loss of a loved one. For Sonoma-based guitarist Bill Horvitz, the death of his larger-than-life younger brother in 2005 was the catalyst for a new jazz suite. Andrew Gilbert reviews Horvitz's new CD, The Long Walk.
Bill Horvitz is probably best known as a guitarist who loves to push boundaries. Starting in New York's downtown scene in the 1980s, and in the Bay Area in recent decades, he's led a series of bands featuring some of jazz's most vivid improvisers. The unexpected death of his beloved 44-year-old brother, New York actor, director, playwright, and choreographer Philip Horvitz, sparked a creative odyssey for the guitarist, as he painstakingly composed and revamped a series of tunes inspired by his brother's larger-than-life persona. Despite the film noir title, The Long Walk is anything but dark and brooding. a suite of 8 tunes that Horvitz composed and arranged for his 17-piece expanded band. The music is rife with incident and drama, playful, nakedly emotional, and layered with thick, fast-moving harmonies. The CD's liner notes set up each piece with a story about Philip, though the music often speaks clearly for itself, like the insistently pirouetting theme, "Do You Want to Dance?" About halfway through the album, just when it starts to feel like a rollicking wake without any weeping, Horvitz lets the grief break through. But rather than railing in anger, he meditates upon the mystery of his brother's life in Where Did the Monkey Go?, which feels something like the concluding theme from an Ennio Morricone score. With brass, woodwinds, strings, and rhythm section all conducted by Oakland-based composer Omid Zufanoun, Horvitz's expanded band references jazz's orchestral tradition, but draws on rock, folk, and classical music too. Much of the music is fully scored, though he leaves sufficient space for his prodigious cast of improvisers, including his brother, Seattle pianist Wayne Horvitz. My favorite piece is Child Star, an Aaron Copland-esque tune that affectionately captures the antic energy and self-assurance of a stage-struck boy. But the payoff comes after the romp, as the band peels away, leaving Shirley Hunt's cello to ponder the inexplicable. Horvitz premiered The Long Walk in 2006, and over the years he's continued to revamp, extend, and edit the music. The album documents the suite's latest incarnation, and he concludes it with the title track, which is also his most recent addition. Set in motion by a devastating loss, The Long Walk isn't about soldiering through hard times. Rather, Horvitz laments that his brother is no longer here to savor the passing parade.
Andrew Gilbert is a Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed The Long Walk by the Bill Horvitz Expanded Band. Any military family can tell you the stress and loneliness soldiers and Marines face when stationed overseas can also be felt at home. But some military moms in the San Francisco Bay Area found a creative way to deal with their worry: singing. Rachel Dornhelm has more on the Swingin' Blue Stars.
Walking into a rehearsal of the Swingin' Blue Stars feels like stumbling across a group of best friends.
Hi!
They meet about once a week in one of their living rooms in the upscale town of Danville, east of San Francisco. They push aside the furniture to face a big picture window. Sometimes they find themselves serenading neighbors.
Yeah, when it gets dark, we can't see out, but they can see it.
But we watch our reflections in the glass, and that helps us a little bit.
Sisters, sisters, though never such devoted sisters, never had to have a chaperone, no sir. We're here to keep an eye on her, caring.
I'm Cindy Sean, and I started the group of singers, but it was never meant to continue for more than a couple years.
It was supposed to be a distraction from worry when, right after 9/11, her son was deployed with the Marine Corps to Afghanistan. Sean had just joined the Blue Star Moms, a support group for military mothers. A natural doer, she organized some fellow moms to sing carols at the local VA hospital. Francie Roberts remembers they started getting lots of calls to sing for other veterans groups. The calls were welcome.
it just took our mind off of it, and learning the songs and knowing where we're going to perform. Because it's you know, you just never know if he's going to be alive or if I'm going to lose him. It was so bad, I even put a lock on my gate, my front gate, because I was so scared to come home and see a black van out there. That was just, we all went through it.
Soon, the small group of women were performing regularly. They decided to learn some of the 40s and 50s songs the veterans loved, and even put together a routine.
Well, we hope we've made you feel like you have been in the USO show and you were back in the 40s and you were just right there with us.
Roberts, whose son Blake spent 16 months in Iraq with the Army, says the audiences seemed to understand what motivated the mothers.
Afterwards, everybody would come up and shake our hands and just give us that extra encouragement that they'll be back, our kids will be back. So we needed to hear that.
And Jimmy will go to sleep in his own little room again.
The sons and daughters of the original members of the Swingin' Blue Stars all came back from their tours. Membership in the group has changed over the years. The current group of women are lifelong musicians. The focus has also shifted to older veterans, says Cindy Marino.
Sometimes they'll be just enjoying it and laughing and having a great time, and the next song they will be crying. And then they'll come up to us, thank you so much for that. That was the last song I danced to with my husband. Or it just brings back so many memories for them. It really is amazing.
There'll be love and laughter and peace ever after tomorrow when the world is free.
The Swingin' Blue Stars have performed everywhere, from community theaters to the new Pearl Harbor Visitors Center in Hawaii. Like the others, Sandy Lewis says 20 years ago, she couldn't have imagined doing this.
It's not about having a huge audience. Just get that one guy out there with that twinkle in his eye and bring that little smile on his face, and we'd sing forever.
You know? Oh, my honey, better hurry and let's meander. Ain't you going to the leader man, ragged meter man.
The Swingin' Blue Stars will spend this weekend, like they do every Memorial Day weekend, performing. For the California Report, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.
Come on in here, come on in here, Alexander's Ragtime Band. Come on in here, come on in here, it's the best band in the land.
And finally today, have you or someone you know been the victim of a scam? Next month, we're devoting an entire show to them, and we're looking for stories about scams that affect people's health, medical identity theft, fake insurance, or scams that take such an emotional toll they affect the victim's health. We want to hear your story. Email us at calreport@kqed.org. That's calreport@kqed.org. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Thanks to our interns, Guy Marzorati and Gina Shalaba. Our editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Ingrid Becker, Bruce Kuhn, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great holiday weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California, and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Teachers Association, celebrating 150 years of advocating for all students, educators, and California's public schools and colleges. And the California Endowment, Health Happens in Schools, at calendow.org.